A typical sortie would involve up to sort of 25 to 30 bow fighters and maybe 40 or 50 escorting single engine fighters. The bow fighter was a tough aircraft, so it could take quite a lot of damage. So even when no bow fighters went down, invariably when they came back, there were a lot of damaged aircraft.
This day was the heaviest loss of any anti-shipping strike mission within the annuals of Coastal Command, seeing 9 bow fighters and 1 Mustang shot down. And the Mosquito crews were already seeing a couple of the German jet fighters up there.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Welcome to the latest episode of Extended, the ETOPS Aviation Podcast. We're ready for takeoff.
Hello and welcome to Extended's Coastal Command series. I'm Tim Robertson and I'm your host for this chapter. In this chapter, we look at RAF Coastal Command's strike wings. In particular, we're going to focus on the North Coates and Banff squadrons. Joining us to talk through North Coates strike wings is David Boyd. David, along with co-author John Vimpany, have written the definitive account of the North Coates strike wings called To Force Them Off the Seas, due for release in the coming months. David is in corporate investor relations with an MBA from Manchester Business School and has worked all across the world. In 2018, David's research paper was included in There Came a Time, Essays on the Great War in Africa, published by TSL Publications. In our second feature on the Banff strike wing, Peter and Ellie talked to highly acclaimed Coastal Command expert and author of multiple books on the subject, Andy Bird. We focus on his book, A Separate Little War, The Banff Coastal Command Strike Wing versus the Kriegsmarine and Luftwaffe, 1944-1945. We started with David and asked him about the background to the North Coates strike wings.
Well, the strike wings evolved really from the failures of the Coastal Command anti-shipping campaign of 1940 to 42. And they evolved out of the lessons learned from that campaign. The background is that the authorities, the high command, had always known that iron ore from Sweden was going to be vitally important to the German war effort. But the planning assumption had always been that it would be the Royal Navy's responsibility to attack those supply lines and to blockade Germany in the way they'd done during the First World War. But when the Germans occupied Holland, Denmark and Norway, that obviously just wasn't feasible. The Germans could clearly base fighters along the coasts and could protect the shipping that was bringing the iron ore down the coast of Norway, from where it went across down the east coast of Denmark, through the Kiel Canal and then down the coast of Holland to Rotterdam. So the responsibility for attacking that supply route passed to Coastal Command. And it was a bit of a hospital pass, actually. Coastal Command wasn't prepared. They didn't have a strategy. They didn't have the resources. They didn't have enough aircraft. The aircraft they had were the wrong aircraft. They were too slow. They were no match for German fighters if they encountered them. And so the first 2 years, in fact, probably up until mid-1942, the Coastal Command anti-shipping campaign was not successful. They sank some ships, but they incurred appalling losses doing so. In fact, the losses were among the highest of any service branch in any theater of the whole war. And it was clear by 1942 that something had to change. And the catalyst for change in respect of Coastal Command being allocated the resources and attention being given to the anti-shipping campaign was probably the Channel Dash in early 1942, when the combined efforts of the Royal Navy, the Fleet Air Arm, Coastal Command and Bomber Command couldn't stop two large German battle cruisers from sailing up the English Channel unmolested.
Yeah.
This was a real blow to the pride of the British government and the British Navy and the Royal Navy, and it was very clear that a more effective anti-shipping strategy and anti-shipping resource was going to be required, and the strike wings basically evolved from there, and the strike wing concept developed during the summer of 1942.
Okay, and the concept, as you say, developed quite effectively out of lessons learned. But how was Northcotes decided upon as a base to start those early strike wings out across the North Sea?
I think it was ideally positioned geographically. It's about an hour's flying time from the coast of Holland, about an hour and 15 minutes from Den Helder or from the Hook of Holland, which is the entry point into Rotterdam Harbour. And there had been Coastal Command squadrons, or the Beaufort squadrons that were used in 41 and 42 had been based at Northcote. So it was an established Coastal Command base, and it was geographically well positioned to base the first of the new strike wings at.
And so how did those strike wings form up? What was the squadron structure, and how did it come about, David?
Yeah, the strike wing concept several major decisions were taken with regard to the anti-shipping campaign and the development of the strike wings. The first was that the aircraft was going to be the Beaufighter. The Beaufighter had been in use by the RAF for several years. It was a night fighter. It was in use in various other theatres in North Africa, for example. But it was decided that the Beaufighter was the ideal aircraft for anti-shipping. It was pretty fast. It was very sturdy. It could carry either torpedo or cannon or rocket projectiles. So they decided the aircraft was going to be the Beaufighter, and that the main attack weapon against shipping was going to be the torpedo. In terms of sinking German ships, they tried high-level bombing, low-level bombing. It hadn't worked. So the decision was made, Beaufighters, torpedoes. And the third thing was strength in numbers. Attacks were to be at wing strength. So each of the wings, and the Northcote was the first wing, each of the wings comprised either two or three squadrons of Beaufighters. And Northcote's initially two, and then a third joined them in January 1943. All three equipped with Beaufighters. 143 and 236 squadrons were had cannon and rocket projectile armaments, and 254 was the torpedo carrying squadron. They were the torbos, as they were called. So three squadrons, two of them in the anti-flak role, and the third one in the torpedo bombing role. And the way that the strike wing concept was executed was at the point of attack, the cannon firing and rocket attack in the anti-flak force, they would climb to about 3,000 feet, and then they would make a fast diving attack against the convoys, in particular the escort ships, and they would seek to beat down the flak defences coming up from the ships. And then a very short time later, ideally less than 20 seconds after the anti-flak attack had gone through, the torpedoes would attack, and they would come in low, about 150 feet, and drop their torpedoes and then open up with their cannons as they flew over the convoys. And so the whole thing was over in about 5 minutes. So that was the structure, basically one or two anti-flak squadrons and then one squadron of torpedo bombers, of torpedoes.
And David, I think from reading some of the accounts, the very early strikes weren't very successful. Predominantly, I think in that first strike from Northcote's, air cover was missed. There was some confusion. It was a bit like a channel dash.
It was a bit of a shambles. And the reason was that the two squadrons involved had really only got together about 10 days earlier, and they'd flown one practice strike. One of the other things that I should have mentioned earlier was one of the other conditions for success that were established for the strike wings was there had to be fighter cover. There had to be Spitfires or Mustangs or single engine fighters above them, keeping the German fighters away and allowing them to concentrate on the convoys. And you're absolutely right, that first strike in November 1942, they didn't rendezvous with the fighters. So they set out without the fighter escort. A number of aircraft had to turn back for various reasons, various technical reasons. One flight missed the turnout to the convoy altogether. So by the time they got out to the convoy, they were significantly under strength and they had no fighter escort. They then didn't coordinate the attack properly in terms of the timing of the anti-flak and the torpedoes. And the result was no ships sunk and several aircraft lost because they were attacked by German fighters as well. So it was the ultimate lesson learned. If we're going to do this, we need to do it properly. And they were pulled out at that stage and new leadership put in, and they were subjected to a very intensive 3-month training program to get them ready again.
Yeah, and that was quite successful when they set about their business after that with a great deal of success, as I understand.
It was. The first strike in this sort of the new wave was in April 43. And it was highly successful. Big merchant ship sunk, no aircraft lost. And then over the next 3 or 4 months, it was 2 or 3 strikes a month.
Just a question. Just in front of the strike wings, one of the key issues was intelligence and reconnaissance.
Yes.
How was that undertaken? Was that undertaken from Northcote's or?
No. Well, supporting reconnaissance was, but the intelligence came down from group. And a group collated intelligence from a number of sources. There was more and more intelligence coming out of the occupied territories about ships sailing. So there would often be some intelligence received at group, and group would then seek to confirm that intelligence by getting the wing to send out reconnaissance aircraft. So if it was believed that there was a convoy at sea, then bow fighters would be sent out singly or in pairs to, usually singly actually, to go and take a look. Then they would find, if they found the convoy, they'd photograph it, hotfoot it out of there, get back to Northcote's, having already signaled that they'd found the convoy, the speed of the convoy, the number of ships and so on. They'd get back, the photographs would be developed, the fighter escort would be arranged. And as little as 2 hours after the convoy had been sighted, there could be a strike in the air on the way to hit that convoy. So it was very much, as you say, intelligence driven at this stage, because there were still a lot of targets. There were still a lot of convoys sailing.
Yeah. And over the next sort of 12 months, Northcote's and the strike wings out there were very busy. The activity was intense. The battles were ferocious. Can you give us some sort of feel for the sort of sorties that were undertaken?
A typical sortie would involve up to sort of 25 to 30 bow fighters and maybe 40 or 50 escorting single engine fighters. And certainly towards the end of the summer in 1943, the Germans had recognized that they were being attacked by something completely different and were responding by adding more escorts to the convoys. These escorts were very heavily armed. So you could have, I think there was one strike, I think it was 19 ships against 87 British aircraft. It was fast and furious. The you know, let's say 25 bow fighters attacking in an anti-flak roll, that's 100 cannon and 200 rockets, you know, being launched at, say, 20 ships of the convoy in the space of 2 or 3 minutes. And then close behind that, the torpedo bombers going in. And when the torpedoes hit these ships, they very often exploded and sank very quickly. So fast and furious action. And then the bow fighters, as soon as they never went back for a second squirt. You know, they'd go through, make the attack, and then they'd hot foot it for home.
Yeah, and one of the challenges they had in some of those early strikes was the direction from which they attacked some of the vessels as well, because they were coming out of Holland, which most people understand the geography there as relatively shallow. Torpedoes were actually exploding along the bottom, weren't they?
Yes, that was one of the other problems in the very first strike in November that we spoke about a moment ago. One of the reasons none of the torpedoes hit was because they did launch them from the Dutch side and they hit sandbanks. So none of the torpedoes reached the ships. So in shallow water, torpedoes just aren't effective. So there was that. You had to be in water that was deep enough for the torpedoes and also far enough away from the shore that you weren't subject to the shore flak defences. And later on, certainly during 1944, the North Coates wing had, late summer 1944, the North Coates wing had run out of convoys to hit. They were a victim of their own success, basically. There weren't enough big German ships making their way down the coast of Holland during the day. They were running by night between the harbours. So the North Coates wing, to get at them, had to go deeper and deeper into the harbours. And that was actually not as successful a period for them. They sank fewer merchant ships and they suffered quite a lot as a result of that. So, yes, if you got too close, if you went into the anchorages at Den Helder around the Hook of Holland and came within range of the onshore flak batteries, casualty rates could be quite high.
Yeah, and of course, as you mentioned, their flak from land-based German positions was also intense. And, you know, there's so many stories, and I'm sure you'll be putting plenty of them into the book, of really heroic strikes through almost impossible conditions.
Yes, they pushed on. I mean, the torpedo bombers, they dropped their torpedoes from 150 feet and got as close to the ships as possible, you know, 800 yards or so when they dropped the torpedoes. So the flak, even if it had been beaten down fairly effectively by the anti-flak defences, was still intense. You know, it was down that low. It wasn't just the big flak guns. It was all the light flak. It was the machine guns on the boats, on the ships as well. So, oh, yes, it was... The bow fighter was a tough aircraft, so it could take quite a lot of damage. So even when no bow fighters went down, invariably when they came back, there were a lot of damaged aircraft. And this was one of the issues, actually, because one of the issues that worried High Command, because it after a successful strike, it could take quite a long time for the, you know, 2 or 3 days for the squadron to be back up to strength, because those aircraft needed to be repaired or even replaced.
Tell us how the strike wings were supported.
At North Coates, there were about, say in 1943, 44, there were about 1,200 people on the base, 1,200 servicemen and servicewomen, of whom 120 were aircrew. So that means for every man in the air, there were 10 people on the ground. And that included the Women's Auxiliary Air Force as well. There were between 150 and 200 waifs at the at North Coates. And the support on the ground were obviously the fitters, the armourers, there was the medical staff, the navigational officers. So there was quite a big headquarters of the wing on the ground, and then there were all these support staff. A damaged bow fighter would come back, and there'd be 3 or 4 aircrew, you know, working full time on it to get it airworthy again, and then the armourers to get it armoured. So it was for every man in the air, there were 10 men and women on the ground supporting them.
Can you tell us a bit about some of the individuals that you've picked up in your research?
Yes, there were some of the individuals involved had very successful careers subsequently. The first leader of the Northcotes wing was Wing Commander Neil Wheeler, who was one of the most distinguished post-war RAF officers. I think he retired as an Air Chief Marshal 30 years later, but he was instrumental in putting the Northcotes, the strike wing concept into action at Northcotes. Rigorous training, really tight adherence to the tactics, never deviating from the conditions for success that were laid down. And he was really instrumental in that first, when he was leading the wing in that first 6 months, making them the success that they were, and really a very, very gifted, charismatic leader. One of the other real characters was a chap called Tony Gadd, who was reputed to have dropped over 1,000 torpedoes. He worked at the torpedo training school before he went onto the wings. And he led the wing on its most successful strike, which was in June 1944, where the Northcotes wing came together with the Langham wing and attacked a convoy coming out of Den Helder and sank both the main targets. And I think they sank two or three escorts as well for the loss of no aircraft. And it was everyone involved in that strike said it was the best one they were ever on in terms of the coordination was just perfect. It all came together just as it should have done. It was the apex of sort of Northcote's strike wing success. So Tony Gadd, and he was a bit of a flamboyant character. In fact, one of his uniforms is still at the little museum at Northcotes. And it was also a very cosmopolitan wing. So there were Australians, New Zealanders. There was a free French crew who were sadly lost. There was a Trinidadian. The morale was very high. It was a very, very happy, successful place to be. And yes, some real characters. Some of the Northcotes people went on to actually lead squadrons in other areas of the wing strike campaign as well.
You've mentioned the museum, and I'd also sort of hinted that you'd visit Northcotes. Mm-hmm. How's the legacy at Northcotes now?
Of the original airfield, very little remains. The wartime runways have gone, but there is a grass runway that runs alongside where the wartime runway was. One of the wartime hangars is still there. Now there are several post-war hangars, and there's the post-war, what was the post-war RAF base is still there, although it's now privately owned by an educational institution. So there's the original hangar, and there is a grass runway running parallel to where the old runway was. And the hangar is occupied by the Northcotes Flying Club, which has been in existence for about 25 years since the RAF left the site. They're very active. They have fly-in days. And they're also very conscious of the aviation heritage of the airfield. The secretary of the club has actually written a very detailed history of the airfield. It's a day-to-day record of the history of the station during its entire existence as an RAF station. And they also have a small, within the clubhouse of the Flying Club, there's a small museum with quite a lot of material, a lot of photographs. There's a model of the way the airfield was during the war. They've got one of Tony Gadd's uniforms and quite a lot of artifacts, bits and pieces of bow fighters that have been found and dug up by local farmers and donated to the Flying Club Museum. So it's a very nice place to visit. And also standing there, you get a real feel for the way it was. Although the runway isn't there and there's only the one wartime hangar, but you're still very close to the shore and you can sort of get the feeling of what it would have been like living there in 43 or 44.
So just bringing this to a conclusion then, David, what contribution do you think the Northcotes wing and more widely Coastal Command made to the outcome of the war?
I think, Pete, you have to look at that on several levels. The first level is, did the strike wings and the Northcote strike wing do what they were established to do, which was to sink German ships and to basically drive them off the sea. And the answer to that, I think, is an unequivocal yes. The strike wings in total, so that's Northcote, Langham, and then the wings around Banff and the other Scottish wings. Between them, they sank over 200 ships. So that was 215, I think, is the number. And that's around 60% of all of the ships sunk during the whole of the war by coastal command. So,
wow.
And certainly by late summer 1944, the shipping routes into Rotterdam had been severely restricted to the Germans. They couldn't sail big convoys down there. They could only sail merchant ships at night. Rotterdam had effectively ceased to exist as a major entry point for iron ore and other war material by sort of late summer 1944. The bigger question, the next level is, well, did that have a real impact on German war production? You know, did cutting those supply lines strangle German industry? And the answer to that one, sadly, is no. German industrial production of arms really continued right through until the end of 1944, by which time, of course, the Allies had been on the mainland of Europe for 6 months and were driving on land towards the Ruhr heartland. I think the reason for that is that the strike wings, it was too little too late. One of the questions we ask in the book is actually, and it's, you know, counterfactual history, there can be no conclusion, but it's intriguing to think actually if the sort of effort had been put in 1942 that was put in 1943, might that have made a big difference? Because the German merchant fleet was at a low ebb in 1942. A lot of their ships had been taken into other theatres or to transport troops to the Russian front. So they were struggling, and actually a big push by the strike wings in 42 might have had a really big impact on their ability to get material into the Ruhr. But as it was, by the time that the Northcote's wing had shut the gate in mid 44, there was enough iron ore in Germany. The industry could keep going. So the strike wings did exactly what they were supposed to do. They did it very successfully. They sank a lot of ships. Their casualty rates were much, much lower. They were still pretty high, but they were much lower than coastal command had suffered during the first part of the war. They had closed the sea. That was their job. Did it have a big impact on German armaments production? It didn't. The other side of that coin, though, is that neither did the strategic bombing campaign, which cost 55,000 lives and countless bombers. It's a whole different debate, of course. But the strike wings were very effective at what they were doing. But one can't help feeling that if the resources had been put there earlier, with a little bit more force earlier on in the war, then they could have had a much bigger impact overall than they actually did.
Hi, Mick Oakey here, Managing Editor of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. Just as Extended is currently expanding your knowledge of RAF Coastal Command, you might be keen to widen your aviation history horizons in other directions as well. Did you know, for example, that around the time the Short Sunderland was entering RAF service, Shorts were breaking with their flying boat traditions and planning a long-range advanced land plane airliner? The project was halted on the outbreak of war, but you can read all about it in our latest edition, TAH-37. Did you also know about the British South Africa Police Reserve Air Wing, established in 1957, in which farmers and businessmen flew anti-guerrilla missions in their own civilian light aircraft, fitted with door-mounted machine guns and homemade grenade chutes? Or that Italy's mighty Isotta Fraschini Asso 750 aero engine, an 18-cylinder broad-arrow monster introduced in the early 1930s, which developed 850 horsepower, is still in production as a marine engine today, 90 years later? You can read in depth about all of this in issue 37 of The Aviation Historian and extend your knowledge. We're print, we're digital, but we're not on sale in newsagents. Order us online and find out more at theaviationhistorian.com.
A year or so after the Northcote strike wings were in place, Banff in Scotland was chosen for further strike wing squadron activity. We turned to Andy Bird for his view on the background to these strike wings, and then explored their role in the strikes against German shipping.
The development of the strike wing concept within the RAF originated by a fellow called Patrick Gibbs. He was a Welshman. He found himself out in the Middle East, flying out of Malta in early 1942, and he was with Beaufort Squadron, and it was basically adapted from his sorties flown hitting the Axis shipping. A constant stream of coastal traffic sailed on a virtually like a dual carriageway up and down the Norwegian coast through the Kattegat, and then continued east of Denmark to the Kiel Canal. Here, the merchant traffic merged as if on a motorway junction and passed up to Bremerhaven and Rotterdam to an assembly point at the Hook of Holland, then sailed onwards towards Brest or the Channel Islands. Norway in particular was an important area for oil and iron ore. It was an essential for the German war economy. In its effort to maintain 22 million tonnes imported pre-war, it had to rely on merchantmen from occupied Europe and Sweden. They made great use of the Norwegian route in the winter of 1939 and 1940 into the German and Baltic ports. At the time when the RAF and the British government were solely focused on France, Germany was able to get into the ports unseen. Whereas going the other way to Norway, Germany was able to export coal and coke for their war economy too. After the Battle of France and the Norwegian campaign, the RAF turns its attention to convoys going along this route. They were occasionally bombed when found, and gradually the Germans strengthened their anti-aircraft batteries on the merchantmen and fishing boats. They had an endless supply of fishing boats. They were the same boats that you would see in fishing ports in Cornwall, Wales and Scotland up in the northeast. They would convert them into mobile gun platforms with vast arrays of anti-aircraft guns, be they 88mm to ordinary 20mm cannon shells. It was therefore necessary for the RAF to develop new tactics. They'd gone out and they'd used their Hamdens and they'd used their Blenheims as well. But when the Bowfighter came along, they had a rugged, more meanable form of fighter to take the offence to the Germans. So they formed a Bowfighter wing based in Northcotes. The cannon-firing Bowfighters acted as anti-flak to saturate the flak ships with continuous 20mm cannon shells, firing from 500 feet down to 50 feet. Behind them, in roughly 2 seconds astern, would be torpedo aircraft. They'd drop their torpedoes at 170 feet, and in theory, they faced less flak because the flak ships had taken out the anti-aircraft guns. Third tactical change saw the introduction of the rocket projectile in early 1943, and this was a game changer. Traffic from the Hook to Cuxhaven was considerably disturbed and began cautiously sailing at night and then sheltering harbours during the day in Den Helder. By the beginning of 1944, there was another change at the top. Air Marshal Sheltered Douglas took over Coastal Command, having been in the Middle East. And at a time when the strike wing concept had proved itself, and aircraft for the command were finally becoming increasingly available, while its air crews were also not being transferred to the Middle East. Also, the opinion among the senior staff had swung from torpedoes to the rocket projectile too. They found that the 25 pound solid head penetrated through the hull of a merchant ship when striking above or below the waterline. It then caused flooding, and hopefully, ultimately, the ship would sink. The traffic plying back and forth the Netherlands and the German coast inshore waters continued after the battles of D-Day and in the Bay of Biscay. They then moved to Scotland. The Mosquito Wing was first formed at Portreath in North Cornwall under 19 Group with number 235 and 248 Squadron and their multinational aircrew. By August, with little left to sink in the Bay of Biscay, they moved up to Banff.
Mosquitoes of Coastal Command take off for a sweep of German shipping up in the Norwegian fjords. Equipped with cannon and rocket projectiles, several dozen of the swift and deadly British bombers approached Nordgulan Fjord.
Banff had been built in the early 40s as a Coastal Command airfield. It was never used as a Coastal Command airfield, and it found itself being used as a sedate flying training base by 14 Advanced Pilot Training Facility. It basically trained pilots from New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, and this started in early 1943 and went on to August 1944. Unfortunately, although they had 150 airspeed Oxfords they were flying, there was a high tally of aircrew deaths, as can be seen in the Banff Cemetery. One of its former instructors was Willie Tate, the commander of 617 Squadron, who dropped the tall boys on the Tirpitz in November 44. On the 1st of September, Arthur Peck handed over Banff to Group Captain Max Aitken, who had arrived from the Middle East, to take over as commander of the Banff Strike Wing. And within days, the deployment of 154 Wing from Portreath moved up to Banff for sorties with the Bay Fighters of 144 and the Canadians of 404. Which had been based at Wick, originally a grass airfield and used pre-war by the Scottish Airways.
Here, between precipitous mountains, was sheltering a Nazi convoy, heavily protected by anti-aircraft batteries. How the Mosquitoes did their job is told in these dramatic pictures.
In addition to the Mosquitoes of the 154 Wing was a unique Norwegian outfit called 333 Squadron, B Flight. A Flight had Catalinas. They flew out of Sullivo, and the Norwegians originally flew out of Lucas. They moved to Banff to act as outriders, so basically going ahead of the Mosquitoes and the Bow Fighters to seek out targets. And they had the unique opportunity of also being the first to receive the Mosquito on maritime ops earlier in the war.
Okay, cool.
And because of this, they were able to use their extensive knowledge of Scandinavia.
Yeah.
The first combined mission of all Bow Fighters and the Mosquitoes from Banff was off Christensund on the 14th of September 1944, when a brace of merchantmen were spotted with two flagships. In 4 minutes, they'd left a flagship and one merchantman of 3,000 tons sunk. Missions were energetically conducted in the fjords and the coastal waters of Norway, ultimately in October, to consolidate and maintain 144 and 404. Bow Fighters, they moved to Dalkey on the Morafuith, and here they were joined by 455 Australian and 489 New Zealand Bow Fighters. At Banff, as the Bow Fighters left, a new squadron arrived, 143 Squadron. They had originally been at Northcote, and they transferred and were swiftly taught to fly the Mosquito. So the aircrews joined 235, 248 and 333 Squadron. The speed and the manoeuvrability of the Mosquito proved really useful in the anti-shipping work. And in theory, it was less vulnerable to the Luftwaffe, Focke-Wulfs and Messerschmitt single-engine fighters based in Norway. However, this wasn't always the case. On the 11th of January, a strike wing was intercepted off Lister by two dozen BF-109s and Focke-Wulf 190s. One RAF pilot, Noel Russell, managed to down two in 2 minutes, and unfortunately it was for the loss of a Bow Fighter and a Mosquito and an Air Sea Rescue Warwick attempting to drop its airborne lifeboat when it was blasted out of the sky by a single BF-109. JG5, the Luftwaffe-based group in Norway, began taking claims left, right and centre. So Mustangs were based at Peterhead to provide fighter cover. Shelter Douglas at the time requested a further Mustangs after 315, the Polish squadron, was moved south to cover Bomber Command Ops. So 19 and 65 Squadron headed to Scotland. This request for 65 Squadron arrived in February 1945, and within days it was in the fray straight away on the 9th of February. This day was the heaviest loss of any anti-shipping strike mission within the annuals of Coastal Command, seeing 9 Bow Fighters and 1 Mustang shot down. by Fokker Wolfs, with the Luftwaffe losing five. This included one of their top air aces, Rudi Lintz, as they hit a Narvik destroyer in a fjord. This was because the Admiralty priority list had Narvik destroyers at the top of the list. And as the tight-knit air crews mourned the losses of nine in southern England, the Admiralty debated on the alterations of merchantmen being put at the top, whilst the Chief of Air Staff also proposed the disbandment of two Beaufighter and Mosquito squadrons. To try and save his squadrons, Douglas Reply used the Bletchley Park Enigma traffic statistics to show Banff, Dalekie and Northcote's wings, disruption of reinforcements to the German army in Europe from Norway, and also the development of the U-boats. To prove their worth, Banff Mosquitoes were reconfigured in March to carry 100-gallon drop tanks and tiered rockets for sorties into the Skattergat. The first, on March the 7th, they strafed seven tank landing crafts with 20mm cannon before firing rockets at 500 yards and 300 yards for the loss of two Mosquitoes. What they didn't realise at the time was these tank landing craft were completely empty. Missions continued at a pace, with the Mosquitoes nipping over Denmark to hit U-boat, and then whilst flying back from one of the sorties off the coast of Scotland, they found a brace of Junkers 188s off Scotland. They downed most of them within seconds, and only two made it back to Norway. On the 2nd of May, as the war was coming to a close, the Mosquitoes sank two U-boats. 2 days later, the Tetsi Mosquitoes, who had left the Banff Strike Wing at the end of January and were now flying from Northcotes with 254 Squadron, sank four U-boats. The last Banff op saw Chris Foxley Norris lead 48 Mosquitoes, which included 404 Squadron. The Canadians, having replaced their Beaufighters in April, and these were escorted by 18 Mustangs. Aircrew pressed home their attack on this last convoy at a low level, sinking two merchantmen, the largest Wolfgang Ross of 3,700 tons, for the loss of two Mustangs with their pilots, which were hit by flak when strafing the ships. One Mosquito from 248 returned with the German Kriegsmarine ensign and the top of the masthead of the ship embedded in its nose after colliding with it at low level when pulling out over the ship.
When the Mosquitoes headed for home, they left burning two escort ships and two 3,000-ton merchantmen.
And Andy, one of the things, just to bring this to a conclusion, you say in the book, is that attacks by the Beaufighters, Mosquitoes of Coastal Command, strikes wings on German vessels must be classified as some of the most dangerous and ferocious encounters. Just bringing this bit to a conclusion, what do you think Coastal Command's contribution was to the success of the Battle of the Atlantic and ultimately World War II?
For the strike wings, it stopped the ply of traffic from Norway, because obviously the Allies at the near the end of the war thought they were going to continue the fight in Scandinavia, and the Mosquito crews were already seeing a couple of the German jet fighters up there. In conclusion, it stopped Germans from being transported from Norway to Germany at the end of the war to reinforce those already there. It stopped iron ore, the traffic along the Dutch and Norwegian coasts. I mean, ultimately, all they used to say to me is, we were just doing our job. For some, it was monotonous. For others, it was sheer excitement. I mean, the youngest guy flying a Mosquito at Banff was 19. He couldn't drive a car, you know. And for others, it was when speaking to one of Max Aitken's relatives, he just wrote, it was, what do you remember? And he just put death, 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 because there was such a high casualty rate. I think at one point the casualty rate was running between 18 and 20%. And in some cases that was higher than Bomber Command. For the wives, there was a cluster of wives up at Banff. They travelled from Portreath, stopped at Hull, and then travelled up to Banff, found digs. Some of them had brought their children. Others were pregnant. For my my part, the reason I got interested in Banff is because one of my mother's relatives flew with 235, and after placing an advert, it snowballed. But ultimately, I was able to find the relative, and he had a six-week-old daughter, which he never saw. Again, Maurice Jabardieu, the Frenchman who died on the 15th of January, he had a daughter, again, which he hadn't seen. But he had. He briefly saw her when he left Morocco. No, it was just harrowing. I mean, there was a Austin Morris car left in a garage at the Seafield Arms Hotel in Scotland, and it was still there as late as 10 years after the war. One of the lads had gone off on an operation and parked, said, oh, you know, can I leave it there?
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
So, that's Chapter 4, covering RAF's Coastal Command strike wings. In the next chapter, we explore the role of New Zealand air crews who served in RAF's Coastal Command with Dave Homewood and guests. We would like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contribution to the show. We'd also like to thank the extended family of supporters, including Mick Oakley at The Aviation Historian and Dave Homewood at the Wings Over New Zealand podcast. Our legal policy and use of material can be found on our website, and please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme is produced with a Creative Commons licence. You can find me at Tim Robinson, at RASTimR on Twitter, and you can find Gareth, Peter and Ellie on the extended Twitter, Facebook and Instagram feeds. Leave us some feedback on this series and engage with us to debate the role of RAF Coastal Command in World War II. And with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from me, Tim Robinson. And remember to stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station, Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
It's taken me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Knowing how to recognise a store, being taught like visually and the basic PPL, it wouldn't bother me.
Thanks for listening to Extended. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extended.
This is XTP Media.